May it please the Court, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, or reintroduce my co-counsel, Thomas Rafferty and Samira Shaw. They're members of the New York Bar and with the firm of Kravath, Swain & Moore. And with the Court's permission, Mr. Rafferty will make the argument on behalf of PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Welcome to the Court, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. As we learned from the 4-3 New York Court of Appeals decision, when we were last here, the law on pari delicto was anything but clear. Now, of course, it is clear, and the defense of pari delicto is alive and well in New York, no matter how bad a public policy we may believe that is. But the question remains, is AIG actually in pari? Forget about delicto for a minute, in pari with PwC. For if there's no imputation of the faithless fiduciary's actions, there can be no in pari delicto defense. And we submit, Your Honor, although did not come to this realization, I think, immediately, and I want to acknowledge that the question that you sent to the New York Court of Appeals was phrased recognizing that the imputation question was not a question for the New York Court of Appeals. It wasn't in the question you asked, and at least with regard to the answer they gave in our specific case, it wasn't what they answered. Now, we also know from the other part of the REFCO decision up there that in New York, there certainly is imputation. But the question is a Delaware officer's and director's actions going to be imputed to a Delaware corporation? And we submit that Your Honors recognized, and we were late to the party recognizing this, although we did argue it, I think, below, although I think it was misunderstood below, that imputation is, because it's an internal affairs doctrine question, a question of Delaware law. Now, I want to acknowledge that if you answer that, yes, there is imputation, that based on the New York Court of Appeals decision of New York law, that the impari delicto defense will bar our claim. But if there is an imputation, there's no way that AIG will be in pari with PwC, and therefore there can be no defense. Now, clearly imputation is not an absolute rule. We don't impute agents' knowledge to principals when the principal sues an agent. Otherwise, a principal could never sue an agent because they'd always have the agent's knowledge. So we make that rule, and we say, well, while there may be a general rule of imputation, we don't impute an agent's knowledge to the principal when the principal sues the agent. And we submit that auditors in particular, and I'm focusing on this appeal only on auditors, that PwC is functioning more like an agent than any other relationship when it comes to PwC, its audit client. And I have statutory support for that in Section 141E of the corporation law, because 141E allows the board of directors with protection to rely on expert advisors who they hire, who are their agents, and give them information. Well, if that's the situation, we're really talking about the auditors as the agents of the audit committee of the board and hence the corporation. Being that agent such that the actions or the ill actions should not be transferred back and forth. And because of that agency type of relationship, because the sole purpose of having the auditor is to look after the company's books, which the part-time outside directors are unable to do, and of course those are the directors that you have to have on an audit committee, is the outside independent auditors, who don't audit committee, outside independent directors who don't have staff, who don't have the expertise to audit, although one of them has to be financially literate, but they don't have the thousands and thousands of people that PwC has to actually do an audit. They have to rely upon them. And if PwC does not adequately do an audit, there isn't a whole lot that the audit committee can do. And because of that, there is this need to say we must hold auditors to some kind of professional standard from those who hire them to do the work.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by
to a professional standard from those who hire them? What does that mean?
In other words, the folks who go, AIG goes out and hires PwC. They contract with them and they say, we expect you to do your job in a professional-like manner. If they are negligent or they commit malpractice, the only way they can do that is if somehow AIG's books are not correct. If AIG's books are correct, no matter how bad they do the audit, there's never going to be any problem. So the only time there's damage from a malpractice or from negligence is if AIG's books are incorrect. Well, the only way they can be incorrect, since the books are, or the financial books are, the responsibility of management, the only way that they can be incorrect is if management is either negligent or worse. And if that is going to prevent PwC from being held to a professional negligence or breach of contract action or anything like that, then really what we've done is we've said there will never be any day of reckoning, any responsibility that the auditor has for its work product.
Is it the access to these books that are, in effect, the creation of management, what makes auditors like PwC different than other professionals who render their services to the corporation?
I think it's the relationship, that the sole purpose that the auditor has is to review the books and records of the company, which they have an expertise in, and no one within the company, no one on that audit committee or that board of directors who are running that company has the same kind of expertise, personnel, or anything like that. Moreover, federal law, if it's a public company, requires independent auditors. So it's a relationship that they must have in order to be a public company. So now we have this kind of interesting, what I call the Amtrak auditor's dilemma. Because if we're going to say that there's attribution, if you go to the Stanford train station, from that train station you can see several of the big four auditing firms' buildings, and an auditor steps on that train and starts heading southbound to audit a Delaware corporation. Well, if they get off in New York City, it's party time, because you do not have to care one whit about auditing the books and records of a Delaware corporation if you get off in New York, because New York has impari delicto, you will not be held responsible. If you stay on the train to Newark, New Jersey, the law is that you have absolute responsibility. There is no impari delicto defense for the auditor whatsoever. And if you continue on the train to Philadelphia, you may, if the auditor is affirmatively a bad actor, if there's some kind of knowledge, then they will have liability. If they're just negligent, they won't have liability. If they're grossly negligent, willfully negligent, I don't know where that stands. I couldn't fully understand that in the AHRF opinion. And I guess in the next appeal, we'll see what happens if they stay on to Philadelphia and get to Wilmington. But for now, the question is, should that be the rule for a Delaware corporation? Or should Delaware directors know that when they hire auditors under 141E, they can rely on them because there's some level of accountability? And if there is a level of accountability, that will get better audits, and that will have more confidence of shareholders in Delaware corporations. And that will add a premium to being a Delaware corporation. Because right now, if you're a New York corporation, that audit isn't worth anything. And if you are a, let me leave it at that. If you're a New York corporation, that audit can't mean anything because there is absolutely no accountability for that auditor. Now, at some point they said, well, and the New York Court of Appeals kind of bought into this, you know, well, if we mess up a public company audit, we can still be sued by the shareholders who've later invested after the fact. Well, number one, not for negligence. And number two, that's not the folks who hired you. And the fact that you could be sued for securities fraud in a public company doesn't protect what happens in a private company. There's no accountability whatsoever. And so if we want to make audits mean something for Delaware corporations, there has to be some accountability. And the way there can be accountability is simply by saying, just like we don't impute the agent's actions and knowledge to the principal when the principal sues the agent, we should also not impute the faithless fiduciary's actions to the corporation when the corporation sues the auditors whose specific job was to make sure that that faithless fiduciary didn't do what he did, and yet they blow that. I've either really wowed you or really bored you. Any questions at all?
Would you address Rule 14 and the issues that the other side's raised about not having this in the opening brief?
Well, I think that the issue was certainly raised below. Then we got here, and the questions, you know, there was certainly questions of whose law applies. And we certainly were focusing, everyone was focusing on the impari part and you know, as the defense. And I think we both took on the issue and somehow got swept up by events and focused on New York law and whether you should send that question to New York. And I think the court rightfully did. But I think that the question of whose law applies when we get to this was not specifically raised in the opening briefs, although there was lots of discussion back and forth, not only at argument, but I think also in the battle as to which questions should get certified. But I think the question of law is almost something that can't be waived. And the reason I say that is you all, the court, has the obligation to decide this case under the appropriate law. If PwC came up and said California law applies, and I say, yes, Washington law applies, and you get together and you say, no, Delaware law applies, you should decide the case with the right law applying what Delaware law ought to be. And not, you know, sometimes the parties do agree on what law, and the court finds otherwise. And I think we gave a couple of examples of that in our brief. So I don't think the parties telling you which law need to apply is something that has to be in the brief or that needs to be preserved. I think that's one of those inherent rules of the court, that it's your job to determine what the right law is. But I will acknowledge that that was not in the opening brief, and I think, as my partner who wrote that said, just because wisdom comes late, it should not be ignored, and it came late to us. I think you all may have focused on it when you decided which question to send to the Court of Appeals, and it probably wasn't until then that we kind of dawned on us, like, ah, I get it. Now I know why they did what they did.
Well, Mr. Grant, if we decline to accept your suggestion that the internal affairs doctrine is applicable here, what happens under a de novo traditional conflicts analysis?
I think the conflicts analysis comes out the same way, that the issue of is it an applicable defense is a New York law defense based on what the court below said when you look at the context where the audit took place and all that stuff. But I think that if you look at where the context took place with regard to the imputation, that would say Delaware law applies because the bad acts were done, you know, to the Delaware Corporation by the officers and directors. And whether you call that a, you know, looking at the acts themselves or looking at the as an internal affairs, I think it still comes out that relationships between directors and officers and their corporation have to be the law of the state of incorporation. I think that's not only U.S. Supreme Court law, but I think it's fundamental to Delaware's position as the corporate capital of the country.
Thank you.
If I could reserve the rest of
your
time
for rebuttal.
Yes, please.
May it please the court. Tom Rafferty on behalf of PricewaterhouseCoopers. I'd like to start, and I think I'm going to be addressing Justice Ridgely's question at the beginning, but I'd like to start from where we ended last time I was here, and that is this court, for the first time in its history, certified a question of law to a sister state court. And the New York Court of Appeals, for the first time in its history, accepted a certified question of law from a sister state's highest court. This court, in its order of March 3rd, recited that it was certifying the question pursuant to Section 500.25 of the New York rules, which provided that the New York Court of Appeals could accept questions, determinative questions, and determinative is the key word here, determinative questions of New York law for which no controlling precedent of the New York Court of Appeals exists. And I believe that explains the meets and bounds of the question the court asked, because the question of imputation was not a question that lacked New York Court of Appeals authority. In fact, in the opinion from the Court of Appeals, they cited two 1800s cases on the presumption of imputation for acts by corporate officers and managers in the ordinary course of their employment. And then it also cited to the Center v. Hampton Affiliates case, which was a 1985 New York Court of Appeals case, which Vice Chancellor Strine relied upon below. Hampton reaffirmed that the presumption was the ordinary rule, the presumption of imputation in New York, and it then went on to define the one exception to imputation that existed under New York law, which is the adverse interest exception. And Vice Chancellor Strine recited or predicted, based upon Center, what he thought the adverse interest exception would remain to this day. And indeed, the New York Court of Appeals, in the opinion that we're here talking about today, said that Center is still good law. It's the law in New York, both on the presumption of imputation as well as the exception to that, which is the adverse interest exception. Now, I want to go back to Rule 14, because I think, and he may just have misspoke, but this isn't a case where someone left out of their opening brief an argument that wisdom came late on and they would now like to put it back in. In fact, the opening brief that was filed before this court on the original appeal here, at page 2, footnote 3, said the following: on this appeal, shareholder plaintiffs do not challenge the Court of Chancery's choice of law analysis. So this is not simply we forgot. This is we made the argument below, and we're now abandoning the argument, not by not making it, not by forgetting, not by having a lack of wisdom, but by affirmatively telling this court that we're not challenging what Vice Chancellor Strine decided on choice of law. Now, I think there were very good tactical reasons for that, because if crediting that counsel now says imputation should have been separated out, if he believes that, and I don't see how you could ever do that, but I'll come back to that. But crediting that, what happened below was they raised the internal affairs doctrine, and Vice Chancellor Strine said that's a weak attempt to avoid the application of New York law, and under the restatement test, there's no question that New York law governs both this contract and this tort claim. Okay, and he went through a thorough analysis of what was in the complaint, where the work was done, the contract was signed, the opinions issued. All of it happened in New York, the principal place of business of AIG, its corporate headquarters. So everything, the misrepresentations that were made to PwC by the management, the false financial records that were created, were all done in New York. And PwC audited the consolidated financials of AIG in New York. So no question that Vice Chancellor Strine got that right. But the tactical reason for abandoning any challenge to that, if one could be mounted, was that if you didn't have a determinative question of New York law, then you couldn't get to the New York Court of Appeals. They could not take your question if it was simply an antecedent question. It couldn't be, we'll decide imputation, but in the meantime, could you tell us what the law would be, assuming that we impute? That's not how that works. They have a statute that defines what they can and can't do by way of certified questions. It's cited in your March 3rd order. That's what happened. This appellant, for whatever tactical reasons were motivating him, decided that he wished, or it wished, to get to the New York Court of Appeals. And the only way to do that was to come and abandon any challenge to the New York choice of law decision by the Chancery Court, and to ask this court to certify to the New York Court of Appeals determinative questions of New York law, not advisory questions on some issue that you might never have to reach. Because what you heard this morning and this afternoon and in his papers is you don't have to get to impari delicto. Just don't impute this bad conduct to AIG, and they can't raise the defense then because the conduct isn't imputed. Well, that's a choice that he made. That's a choice that he ought to be able to live with, and Rule 14 and the rules of most courts that I've been in front of don't have an exception for wisdom came late. I don't believe this is wisdom coming late.
How about plain error?
Excuse me?
How about plain error? If there was plain error by the Court of Chancery.
Well, I believe you could go back and you could review that. I don't believe there's any plain error here, and I'll come back to the merits. I wanted to start sort of with the procedure and why it is that Rule 14 is really the key here, because this is not an accident. It was a conscious tactical decision that didn't work out. And by the way, you're now hearing that imputation was not a big deal. It wasn't in front of the New York court. This appellant, the principal part of its brief, its first point in its reply brief in the New York Court of Appeals was imputation does not apply. Now, what he had done, and let me just be clear, in the court below and in this court, appellant essentially abandoned any effort to prove up the adverse interest exception, because on the facts of this complaint, there was no way you could do that. There was ample evidence of benefit to AIG that the managers who committed the fraud had not abandoned the corporation's interest, but were in fact acting on its behalf. Now, that doesn't work out after you get caught, but during the process of this fraud, they made tens of millions of dollars. They acquired companies with inflated stock because of the financial fraud. They benefited from it. So adverse interest was abandoned pretty much in the Chancery Court. What the appellant told this court the last time we were here, and it wasn't the entire bench, but what the appellant said to the panel was that there were two other exceptions. There was the so-called Tree Plateau exception based on an older New York case, and then there was the innocent insider exception. Appellant argued both of those exceptions to the New York Court of Appeals based upon your certified question. That's in his briefing. We've cited it in our papers. The New York Court of Appeals heard that argument, reviewed the briefs, and went back and rejected both of those assertions. They, in fact, said there is no innocent insider exception under New York law. That would swallow the rule. They also said there is no Tree Plateau exception. There is an adverse interest exception, which this appellant never tried to fit under because he can't. So what we have now is we have a situation where you get a bad result. You've made a tactical decision that you want to be in a different court. You want to argue about a different court's laws, and you lose. You lose 3-2, he says, but you lose. The law of New York is now beyond doubt until this case gets revisited at some stage in the future, if it does. So what do you do then? You come back and you say, well, this is really the internal affairs of a Delaware corporation, imputation. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that argument. One is it's not an argument that anyone's ever made before, and there isn't a single case cited anywhere by the appellant that stands for that proposition. In fact, the rules of the internal affairs doctrine are quite to the contrary. Every court, including this court, who's looked at the internal affairs doctrine, says that it relates to the internal affairs of the corporation, but it has no application where the rights of third parties are involved. And the example that's usually used are tort and contract claims. Well, those are the two claims that are here. There is a contract claim and a tort claim that is largely mirror image. The contract claim is you breached your agreement by not living up to the professional standards, and the tort claim is you didn't live up to the professional standards. The fact of the matter is those are external to the company. PwC is an outside independent auditor, and you heard a very interesting argument this afternoon that perhaps they're an agent. Well, auditors can't be the agents of their clients. There are independence rules that the SEC and now the PCAOB promulgate. There are restrictions on what auditors can do. They cannot manage the day-to-day affairs of a business. They can't prepare the financial statements for a business. That's management's responsibility. What auditors do is they come in either quarterly or at year-end, and they look back. They don't look at every transaction. They can't. What they do is they sample and they test. And then based upon the results of those samples and tests, they render an opinion, their professional opinion. In this case, there's no argument that we rendered an opinion that wasn't in bad faith ever. In fact, the complaint in this case is replete with allegations that the management went out of its way to hide what it was doing, not only from the outside auditors at PwC, but from their own internal audit people. And in fact, those were things that were incorporated by reference into the complaint in AIG's 10K. When they restated their financials, they went through a whole series of matters that were restated and said the reason this wasn't picked up is because it was hidden. And the complaint has, with respect to the Gen Ray transaction, you're going to hear about Gen Ray in the companion case. In the Gen Ray transaction, the complaint has block quotes where people are talking in documents saying, we cannot paper this completely, otherwise the auditors will pick it up. We need to leave this out because otherwise the auditors will understand that this isn't what it seems. So in this case, you've got an auditor who was hoodwinked by its client's management. And now what the client would like to do is to say, we took the benefit of that fraud for years, but we now want to sue the auditor because our people fooled you and you didn't tell them what they already knew, that the books and records of the company were not being kept in accordance with the rules. So I believe, now come to the substance of this, I don't believe that Vice Chancellor Strine committed anything approaching plain error in deciding that an audit relationship between PwC in New York and AIG, whose headquartered was at 80 Pine Street in New York, where the work was done in New York, and the opinions themselves, which were also incorporated by reference into the complaint, are signed and dated New York, New York. That's where the work went on. That's where the opinions were signed. That's where the contract was formed. That's what we're being sued over. Now, I just wanted to touch on a couple of other things. And I mentioned before that this whole internal affairs separates imputation from the substantive law is an interesting argument. It's an argument that no one's ever credited. No one's ever actually even made it. And in fact, if that argument is right, then the Second Circuit, who affirmed the Revco decision on when the certified question was returned from the New York Court of Appeals, along with the New York District Court, along with the New York Court of Appeals, just got it all wrong, because it wasn't New York imputation law that governed Revco. Revco was a Delaware corporation. It had to have been your law. But no one ever thought to say that, because it's crazy. It is crazy to say that a person in New York who contracts with another person in New York who happens to be an employee of a Delaware corporation now has to look to the law of Delaware on imputation to decide what that is. And parenthetically, we may be arguing about much about not much, because your law, as I understand it, and as Vice Chancellor Strine went through it in the companion case opinion on the presumption of imputation for corporate officers and managers, is pretty much the same as New York law. Now, I'll concede that there isn't an awful lot of wisdom in Delaware on the meets and bounds of the adverse interest exception to that. There is the presumption. There is some discussion based on the restatement language about unless you're acting adversely to your principal, but there isn't a lot of law that we were able to find that takes that on point. And there is an awful lot of that law in New York, like the Center case, which the Court of Appeals and Vice Chancellor Strine relied on. So my view is Vice Chancellor Strine got it right. In any event, this appellant before this court said, we're not challenging that because we want to go to the New York Court of Appeals. You gave them that trip. The members of the panel who were here last time will recall maybe that I stood here and said, I don't think these questions are unclear. I do not believe that you need a New York Court of Appeals decision to tell you what New York law is, that's because their jurisdiction is different than yours, many things don't get to the Court of Appeals. But however that worked out, they got to the Court of Appeals. They got to make every argument that they preserved on this appeal to the Court of Appeals under New York law, including imputation, and it was rejected. To come back now and to say, well, I got it wrong. Wisdom came late. What about the New York Court of Appeals? They took a certification from this court on the basis that it was a determinative question of New York law on which there was no New York Court of Appeals decision. They took the briefing. They had an extensive oral argument. And they took the trouble, and you know about this trouble better than I do, to sit down and write a pretty thorough opinion on New York law on all of these issues, addressing each and every one of appellant's arguments. We're now going to go back and say, well, that was all for nothing, because, in fact, there was an antecedent matter that had not only been raised, but had been affirmatively waived by the appellant. But because the appellant doesn't like the way the law in New York came out, we're now going to say, well, sorry, we'll just, you know, say we'll take this out now. And last point, and then I'll, you know, I'm happy to answer questions. I don't want to sort of wear through all of my time, but the idea that imputation is a internal affairs doctrine is simply crazy. because imputation within the corporation, and the reason you don't have Mr. Greenberg and some others here on appeal, within a corporation there is no imputation. The manager of a corporation like Mr. Scrushy from Health South, he can't say, well, I knew I was committing a fraud, and because I'm acting for the corporation, I impute it to the corporation. That's long been the rule. But the fact of the matter is, once you introduce a third party into it, you have to have imputation. Corporations can't act other than through their people. If you upset that rule, and to some extent the rule, Mr. Grant is absolutely right, the rule has been upset now in several jurisdictions, and we are going to be, I will be doing this in a different room in a number of years in the Ahrefs case, because the Ahrefs case has now gotten very confused on imputation, because you don't impute unless you're acting in good faith, but both sides have to be acting in good faith, and I think the district judge in Ahrefs is rightly puzzled by which side does he measure first. The old rule had some harsh consequences, perhaps, but it was clear and consistent. You could deal with the agents of a corporation with the knowledge that as long as they were acting in their capacity for the corporation, you would be able to have their knowledge and conduct imputed to their principal. You're being asked now to carve out a special rule, a rule that says that may or may not be so. You won't know the answer to that question until after the fact, until you get to court. How do you enter into a contract with a corporation if you don't know that the party signing the contract, that their signature and their knowledge is going to be imputed to their principal? How do you do that? That's why the rule is there. This is very much, much like the decision now to say, oops, I missed it, you missed it, he missed it, I didn't miss it. I thought New York law applied from the very beginning. I made that argument in the Chancery Court. I made that argument here. New York law applied. I didn't miss that. But now that New York has come back with something that the appellant can't live with, something that is determinative of these claims and requires an affirmation of the vice chancellor's decision, now he wants to go back and redo it. That's not what this process, as I understand it, is about, and that's exactly what Rule 14 is put in place to prevent. And this is a much clearer case because there was an affirmative waiver than the cases in which someone either drops it in a footnote and doesn't make it in the text or makes it in a way that's ununderstandable or simply forgets to make it. There was no forgetting here. This was a tactical effort to get to New York. He got to New York. He's got the answer from New York. That should be the end of this case. Unless you have any questions, there's time left, but I don't see the point of going on.
Yeah, there's no requirement that you use all your
time. No, I understand, but... You know, I'm certainly happy to take any questions anyone might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That applies to you as well, Mr. Grant.
Understood, Your Honor, but I have a few things that I think we need to clear up. The first is Mr. Rafferty claims that we argued and the New York court decided the adverse interest, the tree plateau. You remember he said all that? If you look at page 35 of the New York opinion, it specifically says, and that in Teachers Retirement System of Louisiana, our case, the certified question should be answered yes, assuming the adverse interest exception does not apply. They didn't decide it. They assumed it doesn't apply. Why? Well, I submit that maybe they realized, too, that that could be a Delaware law issue and not a New York issue. But they certainly did not decide it. And to the extent that Mr. Rafferty said they did, I believe he misspoke. Second, he cites footnote 3 in our brief, abandoning the choice of law argument. I think it's fair to say that that referred specifically to the impari delicto defense and whether that was New York law or not. And in fact, that question of New York law easily could have been determinative, because if New York said like New Jersey had or like Pennsylvania had, it would have been determinative because it would have been the end of that defense. You know, he mentions that the auditor was hoodwinked, and that may actually be true in the end. All we're asking this court to do is to give us our day in court to show that the willingness of PwC to be hoodwinked was negligent. We're not asking to say that their defense doesn't work or that they don't have a defense or anything else. We're just asking for our day in court. Now, Mr. Rafferty says that a person who contracts with someone in New York shouldn't have to worry about whether that person is a director or officer of a Delaware corporation. Well, what happens in the merger context? What happens when a director in New York breaches his or her fiduciary duty to the corporation in a merger context? And what if their partner in that merger happens to be sitting in New York also and aids and abets that? Do we say, well, the agreement took place in New York, all of that happened in New York, so I guess New York applies to everything because you shouldn't have to worry that they're Delaware directors? No, we do not. Aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty is a valid Delaware claim regardless of where the parties are sitting making that agreement. So when he says, why should someone have to worry about when they're contracting where they're sitting, yes, you still have to worry about if you're dealing with a Delaware officer or director. And why shouldn't you have to worry about that? What is so magical about a third party that it demands absolute imputation all the time? And does it mean that any third party automatically gets that, or does it depend on who the third party is? Because I submit there are ample public interest and public policy reasons why there should be a special rule for auditors. Those auditors know when they're dealing with a Delaware corporation, so it's not someone selling widgets to say, well, gee, Mr. Salesman, before I buy widgets from you, are you a Delaware, you know, person or not? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an auditor who knows what is a Delaware corporation and what's not, and they have to know that if they're dealing with a Delaware corporation, imputation rules should not apply, and therefore they're going to be held to a malpractice standard just like anybody else. Mr. Rafferty is right. I can't deal, an appellant can't deal, with the New York law the way it is, and neither should Delaware. It's very, very bad public policy. It gives auditors an automatic get-out-of-jail-free card with no accountability whatsoever. And we see what happens when there's no accountability that turns into irresponsibility that will hurt Delaware corporations. Delaware law should not countenance that. If they have a defense and they met their standard of care, let them have their day in court and let them prove it, and good for them. But they should have to have their day in court, and they don't get a free pass simply because New York is willing to give them a pari delicto defense.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.